You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And we'll address international approaches to Iran sanctions. My name is John Banks. I'm a non-resident fellow in the Energy Security Initiative at Brookings. Our panel today comprises three outstanding Brookings experts. To my right is Fiona Hill, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for the U.S. and Europe. To her right is Erica Downs, a fellow in the John L. Thornton China Center. And at the end is Tanvi Madan, a fellow in the India Initiative. I won't take any valuable time reading their bios. I believe those are provided in the handouts that are available. Our format will follow that of the previous panel. We'll start with introductory comments from the panelists, followed by discussion, and then audience question and answers. The three countries forming the focus of the discussion today, along with the EU, are certainly very critical actors in Iran policy and sanctions, particularly from an energy and economic standpoint, as we heard this morning. The EU, China, and India together as major oil consumers account for about 60% of Iran's oil exports, and with oil sales accounting for about 65% of government revenues and 80% of hard currency earnings. Significantly reduced sales from these three have the potential for very severe impacts, as we have seen, on Iran's economy. And Russia, as one of the world's leading oil producers, certainly is well positioned in terms of its existing pipeline infrastructure, as well as the ability of its Urals crude to substitute for Iranian crude to realize enhanced oil revenues. Of course, as we heard this morning, there are major global economic trends and oil prices playing a role here, as David highlighted. Quite well, I think. The drop in economic demand as well as robust supplies have certainly put downward pressure on prices, and all this seems to have led to a situation in which it's easier for oil consuming countries to adapt to the sanctions. But there is much more to this than oil markets, and this is what we would like to expand on today. As I think Ken phrased it toward the end of his presentation, this is an absurdly complex issue. There are certainly many factors that influence the approaches and motivations of all three countries in the EU that we'll address today. Each has its own set of complex domestic issues, motivations, and interests, not to mention their own approaches to policy with Iran, with each other, with regional powers, and, of course, with the U.S. So we hope today to sift through these complex dynamics and shed some light on the major factors which influence their respective policy approaches to Iran and the sanctions, the current status and impacts of their policy and implications going forward, especially for U.S. policy. So with that, I'd turn it over to Fiona to start the panel comments.
Thanks very much, John, and thank you very much for everyone for staying around for the second panel. You've already covered a lot of ground in the first with our colleagues here. And I'd like to start off first by talking about the EU, and then I'll move on to Russia. The EU is one of the, in many respects, unsung heroes of the sanctions from the United States' perspective here, and that's why I really would like to begin with the EU, because they're generally given quite short shrift in discussions about sanctions, because we tend to fixate on the US sanctions or sanctions at the UN level. And frankly, if it hadn't been for the EU working very closely with the United States, we wouldn't be seeing a lot of the action that we have been seeing over the last 2 years. EU has really played an instrumental role in leading the sanctions initiatives with the United States. And it's been instrumental as the partner, frankly, with the United States in dealing with Iran over this same period. The EU generally has the same sets of concerns the United States have, the same kinds of debates that we're having here play out in EU capitals, in Brussels, and in other cities. Nuclear proliferation, regional security, Iran's role in sponsoring terrorism. And the EU also puts quite a lot of stress on the human rights dimensions in Iran itself. We can pick up on some of these later if anyone's interested. Like the United States, Iran also has the EU countries, rather, as a whole, also have large Iranian diasporas and a very close set of ties with Iran on economic, political levels. There are large numbers of Iranians who used to study in the EU and continue to do so. There are large numbers of current Iranian citizens who live in EU countries because Iran still generally has an open-door policy for its citizens for moving around internationally. And, of course, there are long histories of interactions with Iran dating back, in some cases, centuries, and many of you are well aware of the fact the United States has, in some respects, picked up the mantle of the rather uncomfortable relationship between the country that I originally came from, the United Kingdom, Great Britain and Iran, which Great Britain used to be the Great Satan long before the United States appeared on the scene. Somewhat of an uncomfortable issue there, but nevertheless. And the Iranians actually have some good reasons for being not so happy with the United Kingdom. Remember all those discussions of the Great Game? Well, they also involved Iran. Rudyard Kipling, it wasn't just about Russia and Central Asia. Iran had an unfortunate role to play there, usually as the victim of a UK Great British policy at different points. In any case, we'll move along that way. All of this notwithstanding, the US and Europe have continued to work very well together. The E3, we're always throwing around all these acronyms. There's the P5 plus one. The Europeans also call it the E3 plus three. It all depends on whose perspective you're talking about at this period. But the E3, this mysterious grouping of the UK, France and Germany, UK and France obviously having their permanent positions on the UN Security Council, and the Germans having a significant role to play too. They've all been critical at the UN level. But there's also the role of Lady Ashton, the equivalent of the EU foreign minister and the European External Action Service, which has been playing a very important role in the direct dialogue with Tehran. While everybody else has been flitting around on the UN level, Lady Ashton has actually been meeting, having very serious meetings, the kinds of dialogues that our colleagues were just talking about, with principal players on the Iranian level in many different localities, and has exchanged a number of letters. So Lady Ashton also has a role to play there. The EU has also been very forward-leaning on its own set of sanctions. So we've tended to talk about the US unilateral sanctions, but the EU also has unilateral sanctions, and I know those have also been mentioned in the context of the last panel, because the latest package of EU sanctions that were passed this year in January have really hurt Iran. There's always this this impression that the EU can't really hurt you. Well, the EU's hurting itself quite a lot right now with the Eurozone crisis, but there's a hard edge to the EU's soft power. And while the United States has had very limited trade and interaction with Iran over, for several decades now, that's not been the case, as I said at the outset, with Europe. There's been a lot of trade with Iran. And the sanctions, which have covered not just energy and oil, have really had an impact. And a number of people have pointed this out. Because the EU sanctions have not just restricted Iran's nuclear program, where they've done a lot to hamper Iranian trade on dual-use technologies and a lot of manufacturing goods, but there's also been a series of financial sanctions, especially on electronic payment systems, the SWIFT sanctions. The United States had some experience of that itself a year or so ago. And that's really hurt the operations of Iran's central bank, and our colleague Suzanne Maloney has done a lot of work on this issue. And they've also obstructed Iranian trade with Europe across the board. So we've really seen a downturn in Iranian trade with Europe as a knock-on effect of these sanctions. And the most significant sanction has been the denial of European insurance services for the shipments of crude oil from Iran, which many people have been talking about. And that's had reverberations well outside Europe, including on countries like China and India, which I know will also be talked about by Erica and Tanvi. Many Asian oil importers have had to scramble around trying to figure out how they're going to insure their oil cargoes as a result of Europeans denying insurance provision. Now, all the exemptions that the UN, that the EU has imposed on its sanctions against Iran, so giving breaks, the kinds of breaks that we've just heard have been given for China and Singapore on some of the sanctions by the United States, will actually expire as of this next week on July 1st. So the EU sanctions are actually going to bite even harder than they have already. And this has not been an easy task at all for the EU. And just to conclude on the comments about the EU right now, given the Eurozone crisis, it's been very difficult for the EU to maintain unity. There are three countries in particular that have been very hard hit by the sanctions, especially the sanctions on the oil embargo. And those are the three that are the most vulnerable right now as we pick up the papers on the Eurozone crisis. They may be doing well in the European soccer finals, but they're not doing so well when it comes to the economy. And that's Italy and Spain in particular, and then also Greece. So as you can imagine, it's been very difficult for Brussels to keep up the pressure, and the Italians, Spanish and Greeks have had to scramble to really find out other sources of oil to substitute for their imports from Iran. So this is a very heavy lift for Europe, and Europe continues to deserve a great deal of credit from the United States. So I'll move on quickly to Russia and try not to take up too much time, but I know that there was a question from Randy about, well, what are the Russians up to, and then obviously the Chinese, and we can talk about this a little bit more. Now, Russia is actually part of this E3 plus 3, because the three are Russia, the United States, and China at the UN level. But also Russia has a different role to play, along with China and India, because of their perceived roles as rising powers with very divergent interests when it comes to the E3 and the UN and the United States. Russia guards its UN status very jealously, and the UN and how Russia plays in the UN factors into Russia's calculations about what it's thinking about when it deals with Iran at this level. Russia traditionally is not a fan of sanctions. I mean, not just traditionally, but period. They're not a fan of sanctions. They're not a fan of sanctions at the UN level because they often get targeted against Russia. And they're certainly not a fan of unilateral sanctions, be they EU sanctions or US sanctions, because these do hurt Russian interests. And again, Russia is very well aware that the United States Congress in particular likes to also sanction Russia. In fact, we've got a whole raft of sanctions against Russia that we've just imposed. So Russia has a long history of blocking sanctions at the UN level and certainly trying to undermine everybody else's unilateral sanctions. And this goes across the board, irrespective of what they're thinking about Iran at a particular time. Now, you might point out that, of course, Russia went along with the last draft of UN sanctions, 1929, back in June 2010. And there was a number of factors at play there that I'll try to tease out a little bit, and we could talk about more in the questions and answers, and I'm sure will come up in the context of China and India. The first factor there was Iran really made Russia angry. Iran and Russia have a long history of interstate relationships, and they also have a long history of cooperation to some degree on the civilian nuclear program of Iran, as everyone is well aware. But Iran concealed information about the extent of their nuclear weapons program also from Moscow. The revelation about the secret site at Qom was a revelation also for Moscow that prides itself on actually knowing more about what's happening than everyone else. Well, this time they found out that they didn't. And they were particularly angry that Tehran had managed to conceal this from them as well. In addition to the anger with Iran, Moscow was also trying back in 2010 to calibrate all of its difficult relationships with everyone else, not least with the United States, but also with other key players in Europe, most specifically Germany, which is the key political and economic interlocutor for Russia and Europe. And the Germans were pretty far-reaching on their response to Iran as well, and they have been one of the driving forces in Europe in terms of imposing sanctions, and the Germans put a lot of pressure on Russia. They're the biggest importers also of Russian natural gas and also a major importer of Russian oil, so the Germans do have a few levers which they can play with the Russians. The other country that the Russians were factoring in 2010 has already been mentioned in the last panel, and that's Israel. I think already David Goldman and others brought out the fact that Israel's relations with a lot of the major players have changed quite dramatically over the last several years, and that's very much the case with Russia. We've just seen Mr. Putin on a state visit to Russia. You wouldn't have seen many secretary generals of the Soviet Union on state visits to Israel in the past, and that just underscores how much the relationship with Israel has changed as a result of the 1 million plus population in Israel now that is Russian-speaking, having emigrated from the Soviet Union over several decades. The relationships have changed in other ways too, in that Russia, is very much like everybody else, is very interested in Israeli technology, be that software, computer technology, but also UAVs, drones, that Russia has failed to be able to replicate itself, and I think we'll find out that that's the case in other countries. So Israel is a different factor also for Russia. Israel put a lot of pressure on Russia. The same with the Gulf countries, especially Saudi Arabia. Given everything we talked about at the last panel, the role of Saudi Arabia with its hand on the spigot of oil production is a very important one for Russia. Russia's economy remains very much dependent on oil and oil prices, and it's Saudi Arabia, not Russia, of course, that calls the shots on the international oil stage in terms of being able to affect the price of oil. So Russia is very mindful of that relationship, and plus Russia is also a large arms seller to the Gulf and to the Saudis, and again, more levers that the Saudis have to remind Russia of some of their interests. And then, of course, there's the question of really how Russia factors in the larger relationship with Iran, apart from being angry with Iran about the Qom program. There's the Russian trade with Iran itself, and this is actually much less than people usually factor. There's all this idea that the Russian role in the nuclear program in Iran, the building of the Bushehr reactor, is a significant feature for Russia when it thinks about whether it should support Iran or not. In fact, Bushehr has already been built, the money has already been spent, and where Russia might have been hoping many years ago that Bushehr might be a flagship for the renaissance of its nuclear program, let's just say nuclear programs around the world are not in a renaissance stage right now, thanks to the Fukushima disaster and, of course, all of the anniversaries of Chernobyl that have been cycling through the news recently. Russia's nuclear program is hardly a great model for the future, and John has been working on these issues for some time and can certainly underscore this. There's not much hope that Russia is going to get more contracts globally as a result of having built Bushehr, so that's just not an issue anymore. In terms of Russia's arms sales, those have been a priority over the years, but again, there's been a lot of pressure from other purchases of Russian arms for Russia not to sell to Iran, and there was the classic case of the S-300 missile defense system that Russia was going to sell to Iran in 2010 that was pulled back, largely from pressure from the Saudis and others who would otherwise be buying from the Russians. So basically, overall, the trade with Iran has not been as significant as it has been in the past, so that's not really been a factor. It's just the strategic relationship with Iran that remains a key element, and I think we can talk about this more in the Q&A. It's how Russia tries to factor in Iran's role regionally. There's the Syria issue. There's all the different questions that we've had on the table in the last panel that Russia looks at. So Russia's always looking at how is Iran going to play in larger strategic questions, and then the interaction with our other topics of discussion here, China and India, and how everybody else is going to be factoring in Iran and the relationships with the United States. So it's the strategic element that remains the biggest question for Russia, and they always calibrate that on where things are standing at a particular juncture. So I'll hand over now to everyone else.
Erica?
Okay, good morning. I'm going to discuss China, and what I'd like to do in my allotted time is first to review quickly some of the factors shaping China's response to the U.S. sanctions on the Central Bank of Iran. Then I'd like to discuss China's response so far to the sanctions, both at the level of the Chinese government and at the level of China's oil industry. And finally, by way of conclusion, I'd like to say a few words about the 180-day exemption that the Obama administration granted to China yesterday. So in terms of the factors that have been shaping China's response to the sanctions on the CBI, these are in no particular order, but I'd like to highlight five. The first one are Chinese views on sanctions. Like the Russians, the Chinese are no fans of sanctions. Like the Russians, they find unilateral sanctions to be more distasteful than multilateral sanctions. And like the Russians, they have a history of being subject to U.S. and European sanctions. A second factor is energy. China's national oil companies have upstream investments in Iran, and they also buy a lot of crude oil from Iran. Last year, Iran was China's third largest supplier of crude oil behind Saudi Arabia and Angola, and China imported north of 550,000 barrels per day from Iran. A third factor are China's concerns about nuclear proliferation. China, like the United States and other players, does not want Iran to acquire a nuclear weapons capability. However, that said, in my view, Beijing probably regards a nuclear-armed Iran as less of a national security threat than the United States does. A fourth factor would be China's relationships with key players on the Iranian nuclear issue. So that includes other permanent members of the UN Security Council, as well as regional actors like Israel and Saudi Arabia. I think it's fair to say that of those different actors, the United States is probably the most important because the China-U.S. relationship is China's most important bilateral relationship. And while Beijing, you know, doesn't want to see tensions over Iran increasing friction in the bilateral relationship, I think it's also sort of tired of repeatedly being asked to play ball on the subject of U.S. unilateral sanctions. And finally, the fifth factor I'd like to highlight are the corporate interests of a Chinese oil company called Sinopec, who's actually a key player in this drama on the Chinese side. Sinopec is the biggest Chinese buyer, and probably the biggest buyer overall of Iranian crude. And almost all of the oil that China imports from Iran ends up in Sinopec's refineries. However, Sinopec also has ambitious plans to expand its presence in the American upstream, and I'll say more about that later. So how has China responded to the U.S. sanctions on the Central Bank of Iran since President Obama signed them into law on December 31st? And I'd like to address this question from both the government level and the corporate level. The Chinese government has been sort of consistent in its response, at least publicly, over the past 6 months. And the statements that we repeatedly hear from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beijing is that China is opposed to unilateral sanctions, that the U.S. sanctions on the CBI are not going to have any influence on China's energy trade and investment ties with Iran, and that the sanctions that China is complying with are the U.N. sanctions on Iran and China's energy ties with Iran, the oil that it buys, the investments that it makes, are compliant with those sanctions. However, when we look at how Chinese oil companies are responding, the story is a bit different. As I mentioned earlier, a Chinese company called Sinopec is the biggest Chinese buyer of Iranian crude. And every year in late November, early December, Sinopec sits down with its Iranian counterparts to negotiate their oil contracts for the following year. So in late 2011, when Sinopec sat down with the Iranians, new U.S. sanctions on Iran, sanctions on the CBI, were already a done deal. And Sinopec knew that, and so it sought to take advantage of Iran's increased impending international isolation to press for lower prices and a longer credit period. And as many of you know, this contract dispute dragged on until late March. And as a result of this dispute, we saw China's oil imports from Iran plunge. They dropped by more than a third in the first quarter of this year. And through the first 5 months of this year, they're down 25%. There's been a lot of discussion in the press about what was the driver of this dispute. Was it just a commercial dispute, or were there political overtones? And my take on this is that this is really a case of commercial activity creating political opportunity. And what I mean by that is that I think Sinopec had strong commercial reasons to press for better contract terms. As I mentioned before, it's the biggest Chinese buyer of Iranian crude. When oil prices get above $80 per barrel, Sinopec, as China's largest refiner, is the one that's most hurt by Chinese state set controls on refined product prices. And so it had very strong reasons to try to get the Iranians to sell for less and to give Sinopec a larger period to pay for that. However, I think that this dispute really provided the Chinese government with a political opportunity. And what I mean by that is it provided Beijing with a way to sort of be supportive of the U.S. sanctions on Iran without ever having to admit that that's what they were doing. As you probably know, there haven't been any public requests from Beijing for a waiver. There haven't been any statements that we support this enterprise and therefore we're going to go along with it. And so that's what I meant by commercial activity creating political opportunity. And I should also mention that I think Sinopec also has strong reasons not to dramatically increase its liftings from Iran. And in fact, Sinopec earlier this month announced that it's actually targeting reductions of 16% to 20% in its imports from Iran over this year. And I think one of the commercial incentives for Sinopec to do so is what I mentioned earlier, which is that they have big plans to expand in the United States. Earlier this year, Sinopec agreed to invest $2 billion in shale assets owned by Devon Energy, so that's more than they've pledged to invest in upstream projects in Iran. And there are reports in the Financial Times last week that Sinopec's actually looking to buy assets in the U.S. from Chesapeake Energy. And the head of Sinopec is a man named Fu Chengyu, and he, many of you may have heard that name before because he was the man who ran CNOOC, or China National Offshore Oil Corporation, when CNOOC made its bid for Unocal back in 2005. And so Fu knows from going through that experience how getting on the wrong side of politics in Washington can really scuttle a deal. And so my sense is that he and Sinopec had very good reasons not to take advantage of Iran's isolation and buy up lots of that crude that's sitting on tankers. Because even though Sinopec, as an oil company, not a bank, isn't going to be sanctioned under the sanctions on the CBI, I think he's quite aware of the political optics and how this could play out in a negative way for Sinopec politically. And finally, by way of conclusion, I'd just like to say a few words about the exemption that was granted to China yesterday by the Obama administration. It looks like that exemption was granted based solely on the number. Some U.S. officials have come out and said the Chinese have reduced their crude imports from Iran, you know, by 25% so far this year. In our book, that constitutes a significant reduction, so we've given them a 180-day waiver. In my view, that is justified if you look at the percentage reductions and the volume reductions of other countries that have gotten exemptions, especially other buyers in Asia, because it is countries in Asia, China, India, South Korea, Japan, you know, that rank among or have ranked among Iran's largest crude oil customers. As I just mentioned, China's imports from Iran are down 25% for the first 5 months of this year. That compares to 33% for Japan and 16% for South Korea. However, if you calculate the volume reductions, and if you look at the number of barrels less that the Chinese are buying, the South Koreans are buying, Japanese are buying, that you know China has actually reduced its imports the most, you know, in terms of volume. That their 25% reduction in terms of barrels is actually greater than the 33% reduction from Japan. And so, I think that certainly based on the numbers, the administration had a strong case for giving China an exemption. You know, of course, I suspect there are critics out there who might say, well, yes, but even though there has been this 25% drop, China's imports from Iran are now on the rise because the contract dispute has been resolved. And by the way, the Chinese never actually came out and said they were reducing their imports for, you know, because they support U.S. sanctions, that, you know, the narrative is that it's been a contract dispute. But that aside, if you just look at the numbers, I think there was a case for an exemption. That being said, looking forward, as many of you know, these exemptions are only good for 180 days, and I think that it might be more challenging for China to secure another waiver in the future simply because China's liftings from Iran are now back at their 2011 levels. In May, China imported 520,000 barrels per day from Iran, and so I think that things might be a little trickier 180 days from now when the next determinations have to be made. And I'll stop there. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Good morning. Before I start, I just want to repeat an observation I made to Tammy that while women might not have it all, we definitely have majority participation in this event. I'm going to cover India, and I'm going to do this in three parts. The first to actually address why India is part of this discussion. Second, to look at what India's reaction to the sanctions have been. And third, to kind of break down in two parts the factors influencing India's response, both influencing its response towards maintaining a relationship with Iran and those that are those factors that have been limiting the extent of India's relationship with Iran. India is part of this discussion because it's one of the largest importers of Iranian crude oil. It's traditionally been, for the last year or so, the second largest importer, but for a while, because of the Chinese reduction of its imports, became for a bit there in the spring the largest importer of Iranian crude. India, in about 2008 or so, Iran used to be the source of about 15 to 16% of Indian oil imports. India has reduced this amount to somewhere between 9 and 10% this year. The reasons for that, and now it's Iran has dropped down to about being from being the second largest supplier of crude to India to the fourth largest supplier. The reasons for that reduction, the Indian government says that it is not a result of just U.S. sanctions or EU sanctions, but sanctions have had an impact on what India can practically do in terms of importing Iranian oil. One has been in the payment question. India has had trouble paying for the crude. They've found a way to deal with this to a certain extent, which is to pay Iranian crude in rupees. That has had its own problems, and India is only paying for about 45% of the crude that it gets from Iran in rupees. And there's a problem with what Iran is going to do with those rupees, because Indo-Iranian commercial ties haven't been that strong. It's tended to be very much in Iran's favor in the past. The second has been what has got mentioned quite a bit today, which is shipping. Most Iranian oil that came to India was covered by European or U.S. insurance companies. They're not going to be able to get that insurance coverage. India is this week grappling with how to deal with that. A couple of suggestions have been, or options have been thrown out by the Indian government. The first was for Iranian ships to ship the oil. There are obviously limits on that capacity, as well as not just capacity in terms of how much can actually go towards India, but also Indian port capacity and the resistance on the part of Indian shipping companies who don't want to give up those routes. The second option that has been explored and just been announced last night was to have Indian shipping companies insured by the public insurance company, and the government has asked the insurance company to do that. There's also a question of where that company is going to get reinsurance from. So they're still dealing with that. The second reason India has reduced, has managed to reduce how much it's actually importing from Iran, and just to give you a sense, on the basis from last year in May to this year in May, India's reduced imports by about 37-38%. The second reason has been India's policy of diversification, which is not a result of sanctions. It's actually been at least an attempt to, India has attempted to diversify its kind of sources of crude supply for the longest time. It has had limited success in some senses in terms of doing so. But one thing that has happened that has been key for India in the last year or so is that Iraq, which was traditionally a key supplier from India, has come back on stream. It is now India's second largest supplier once again. The other aspect has been is Saudi Arabia is now offering up India more oil as well. So India is actually always, not just in energy policy, but across the board, diversification has been a key element in all kind of international policy, and it's actually trying to continue to kind of move away from not just Iran, but the Middle East in general. So it's also looking outside the Middle East for sources of supply. The third, which won't get acknowledged explicitly, but has been the diplomatic aspect, both pressure and persuasion, implicit and explicit, from not just the U.S., but other key parties that India has important relationships with, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. And I'll talk about this a little bit more in kind of when I talk about the factors influencing India's response. Where things stand right now is India has got an exemption from the U.S., so this will probably come up again in 6 months, depending on whether India maintains the level of reductions that it has currently put in place. But India currently has got that waiver from, and so it's kind of the subject has died down, especially in domestic politics in both countries, which had been a key driver of the discussion. In terms of the factors influencing the Indian response towards maintaining a key relationship with Iran, the first is the energy factor. India imports about 75-80% of its oil, and so even 9-10% of that is fairly key. The Indian economy is currently at a fragile point. It's doing not badly, but it's still not doing the kind of hitting the kind of numbers that it was even a year or two ago. So the energy question is very key, not just in domestic politics, but also in for the economy. So Iran will remain a core supplier for India. Iran allows India to diversify. India has no desire to give up, to kind of take reliance on Iran for that 15-16% and entirely shift it over to the Saudis, for example, or to kind of continue to just, even to Iraq. They would like to keep it even within the Middle East fairly balanced. Third, Iranian crude is not easily replaceable in terms of Indian refining capacity. It has become more replaceable than in the past, but it still cannot be replaced just entirely, and especially not overnight. And finally, Indian energy companies do not want to, oil and gas companies especially, don't want to entirely cede ground to countries like China in the medium to long term. So they want to have a continued relationship with Iran in the energy sector. The second key aspect of a reason for India maintaining a close relationship is Afghanistan. India sees Iran as a major land route to Afghanistan and Central Asia, especially in the absence of having that route through Pakistan. India has been helping develop the port of Chabahar, And sent its first shipments through there to Afghanistan in spring, and it plans to continue to use that route over the long term. Especially in the context of a U.S. drawdown in Afghanistan, that becomes, and uncertainties associated with that, that becomes more important, that route becomes more important to India. That brings its own questions about how much dependence that, you know, reliance India will have to have in Iran, which it won't like. On that front, but that is a question that is going to be have to dealt with in the medium term. The third is commercial interests. While they're limited, they're growing. There's a lot of interest in Indian companies in actually finding markets in Iran. There is interest in expanding that relationship. What that has been doing is, to a certain extent, you have Indian companies and the Commerce Ministry, for example, arguing that India should actually find a way to exploit this opportunity when other countries are not operating in Iran. That's why you've been hearing different voices in the first 6 months. There are different bureaucratic positions across the bureaucracy on this question about what to do. The Foreign Ministry, the Commerce Ministry, the Finance Ministry have been speaking with different voices till very recently, and they were asked to all come on the same page and follow the government line on this question. But that was one of the reasons you heard very different answers about what India should do with Iran in the long term. The final aspect that gets mentioned in the first paragraph of any speech on Indo-Iranian relations by most Indian and Iranian leaders are the historical and cultural ties. I think the cultural ties, especially because of India having one of the largest Shia populations in the world, while it's a minority amongst India's Muslim population, it's still a fairly large number. The historical and civilizational ties and even the cultural links, I think they're a bit overestimated. They didn't seem to have worked in mitigating kind of the negative relationships that the two countries had through most of the Cold War and even through the beginning of the 90s. So I think they get overestimated in terms of how much they actually draw the two countries together. I think they do create a certain sense of sympathy in India for Iran, but I think in terms of a decision-making aspect, I think they have limited impact, and some of the other factors have more of an impact. Quickly, the factors limiting India's ties with Iran. First, on the energy question, Iran has not been all that reliable. It has given Indian oil companies and gas companies a lot of trouble. So India questions Iranian reliability in the medium to long term. Indian companies have often found that China has been given priority. They've been given short shrift. So they will look at, they won't kind of totally lose their wariness of interacting with Iran. India has also felt that Iran has gone back on price negotiations under a number of contracts. So there are still issues, even on the energy question, that make India hesitate to depend more and more on Iran. Second is kind of more a strategic problem in terms of India's relations with Iran creates for other key relationships. I can talk about the U.S. more in detail in Q&A if people have questions. But India's relationship with the U.S. is a key part of its foreign policy. The relationship has become not just broader, but deeper in many ways. The other country is Israel, which has become, again, a key partner of India. Doesn't get acknowledged that much publicly for domestic political reasons in India, but it has become one of India's largest defense suppliers. So even in kind of a hardcore security interests, it's a key relationship for India, one that India does not have any interest in giving up anytime soon. The third kind of set of third parties is Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, which are not just key energy suppliers, or both oil and gas to India, but is also where a large Indian diaspora resides. They are important to India not just because they're a diaspora, but because of remittances that come from there. So India has an interest in maintaining a relationship with these countries. Third, on the non-proliferation question, India does not like Russia and China, India does not like unilateral sanctions. It's been a target of them in the past. It does not think that they are effective. Having said that, India has no desire to see Iran go down further towards a path towards nuclear weapons. It sees that as destabilizing the entire Middle East, which not just because it's a source of energy for India, at a time when the economy is not exactly in the best state, but also because of the diaspora and the number of people of Indian origin who stay in that part of the world, India has no desire to see an unstable Middle East. And because of its growing relationships with Israel as well, does not want to see an Israel-Iran conflict get exacerbated. Finally, and this is kind of more a question that has come up recently, is the question of terrorism. I think it was brought up earlier in the panel, the attack on the Israeli diplomat or the person connected with the Israeli embassy in Delhi in the past few months. While the Indian government tried to play it down, it has acknowledged multiple times that it sees links between that attack and not just it has named suspects Iranians, but Iranians who are potentially connected with the Iranian state. It has very clearly linked those attacks with the attacks in Malaysia and Thailand and Georgia. If this was designed to have the effect of actually making the Indian public question the relationship with Israel, has had the opposite effect. It's created a sense of solidarity. It has created a source of tension between India and Iran. But the other thing is India cannot afford to just ignore this because if it takes the stance that any attacks that it sees is directed either from Pakistan or directed by elements connected to the Pakistani state are subject of much kind of negativity between those two countries, it can't ignore similar attacks that seem to be similarly coming from or linked to another state in this sense, Iran. So that's created another source of tension between India and Iran. And I'll just stop there.
Great. Thank you to each of you for those comments. One of the themes that seems to come out here is the obvious complexity and variety of interests that each country in the EU has. And Erica alluded in her comments a bit to some of the shared interests with Russia in particular. I wanted to ask a two-part question on where the panel sees emerging or converging interests amongst the countries as well as diverging interests and how that is evolving and could evolve. And then related to that, one of the issues that seems to be shared, one of the goals that seems to be shared is that no one wants to see Iran develop a nuclear weapons capability. That seems to be a shared interest. And, of course, everyone is on board at the moment in a diplomatic approach to addressing that. Are there any lines in the sand across which Iran cannot go for these countries, which would change their policy calculations, perhaps elevating that goal above economic or trade interests or cultural ties?
Shall we have a go at that?
Have a go.
I think what struck me in listening to all of this, and I'm sure it struck many people in the audience, is that China, India, and Russia in particular are all weighing up the same sets of relationship with the same sets of players. With the United States, very similar concerns, the desires to avoid being the target of sanctions themselves, not being big fans of sanctions, but feeling that they have to factor the important trade, economic, and political relationships in with the United States and how the United States plays on the global stage. And then this whole array of other countries that often don't get discussed at events like this, the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia obviously always comes up, but the Gulf overall and then Israel. Israel, in some respects, seems to be a common factor among all of the states with a new dynamic relationship. And I think we have to bear in mind here that each country's sets of relationships do not remain static. If we'd still been thinking about the old Soviet Union, we would never have factored Israel in the way that we are today. And perhaps that wouldn't have been the case also with China and with India. The fact that the Chinese, the Indians, and the Russians are all concerned about what does Israel think and how the relationship with Israel on defense issues will be affected by decisions that they make on Iran is really quite a new phenomenon. And that also brings up the question of the weapons, the nuclear weapons capability. I think it's fair to say that all three countries, China, Russia, and India, have the same sort of perspective on Iran's nuclear weapons program. They do not want to see Iran acquire a nuclear weapon, but they may also feel that there's not much that they can really do about it. And they have probably a very different assessment from the United States and certainly some of the countries in Europe, but maybe not all of them across the board, about what one can do to deal with this issue. The Russians certainly are much more in the thinking about the inevitability of Iran getting a nuclear weapons capability, whether it's the breakout capability or the actual acquisition of a weapon. they're really trying to figure out for themselves whether the Iranians intend to really go for the weapon or whether they just intend to reach that threshold that other states have seemed to have reached where they could get the weapon if they wanted to. So they're trying to figure out, is Iran going to take the step of North Korea, or are they going to take the step of all the other countries that shall not be named that are really nuclear weapons states, but we don't really say that they are. And the Russians are hoping that it's that latter, that Iran will, you know, simply have it, we'll all know they have it, but they won't really do anything about it, and they won't go down the rather insane path that the Russians think that the North Koreans have gone down. Do they really have to do this? The Russians are really where the Chinese are on this, and hoping that the North Koreans will one day have a change in policy. So the Russians really kind of then try to figure out, then what can you do to try to persuade the Iranians not to go down that more difficult path? And they really believe that sanctions is not the way to go, that it's really trying to find other ways of getting hooks and levers into Iran and to dealing with them. And just like everyone else, that they're frustrated with the fact that their own diplomacy and their own behind-the-scenes interactions with Iran don't really seem to get them as far as that they think that they should. But they really would prefer that we all basically start to think about that containment option, about how you work with Iran to turn them off into a different direction. And I think that's probably where we'll find that China and India are really too. They're trying to figure out how to deal with what they see as the inevitable and try to prevent the knock-on consequences from this. And they really feel that through their web of relationships, by dealing with the Saudis directly, dealing with the Israelis, and really dealing with a whole set of complicated and complex sets of relationships behind the scenes, the Russians love to make deals, but deals that nobody knows about. That this is really the way that they can address this. I think the biggest line in the sand then is not so much where the Iranians are really going, but is what the Iranians do. And this is where I think you will also find a shared concern about Iranian sponsorship of terrorism. So far, the Russians have actually been quite happy with Iran's interactions with them on the issue of Russia's Muslim population. Unlike India, Russia really doesn't have much of a Shia Muslim population. The bulk of Russia's 14 million Muslims are actually Sunni Muslims. And Russia is much more concerned about the role of Saudi Arabia or even countries like Turkey in terms of their outreach, their cultural and religious outreach to the Muslim population. They're building in mosques, their sponsorship of schools. In fact, Iran was Russia's partner in building a state-sponsored Islamic university in Russia's Volga region. The first person to actually visit the school was Khatami, rather than any other representative of any other Muslim country. So there's been a very interesting role that Iran has actually played in helping tamp down extremism in the Russians' view, and the Russians worry that, in fact, Iran might take a different tack at some point. So if indeed there is a stepping up of Iranian-sponsored terrorist acts in countries close to Russia, Azerbaijan and Georgia, which Russia has been watching quite closely, or there are more evidence of attacks in India and elsewhere, that might make the Russians extremely nervous, because the last thing the Russians want is more radicalization of Islamic groups in their neighborhood. And Russians are very concerned about how then Iran is going to play out on Syria and a number of other issues, which is why they're always making these complex calculations. So I think that would be one of the issues that really would get the Russians most excised and most concerned.
John, I'm going to take your question about lines in the sand in a slightly different direction and link it to the question that was asked at the end of the last panel about U.S. efforts to get China to play ball on Iran and the nuclear issue. At the beginning of my remarks, I had listed a number of factors that I saw as influencing China's response to the sanctions that Obama signed into law on December 31st. But if we step back further in time and look at China's response to other U.S. unilateral and U.N. sanctions on Iran and what the U.S. has done to get China to cooperate, there are, I guess, a couple other factors that I think are worth highlighting in terms of sort of getting China to move somewhat on this issue. And one is, I did want to elaborate on the sort of the U.S.-China relationship. As many of you know, when President Obama took office, he identified nuclear nonproliferation as one of several global issues that he wanted to work with the Chinese on to address. And so that elevated, I think, the importance of the Iran issue in Chinese foreign policy because the U.S. is such an important bilateral relationship to China, and because President Obama was saying this is one of the issues that I want to work on in our relationship. And certainly, if you look back, and there has, as time has gone by, more and more information about the efforts of the Obama administration to get the Chinese to sign on to 1929 and to partially comply with CASADA, with a comprehensive Iran sanctions accountability and divestment act that was implemented in 2010. We can see that Iran was often the top item or one of the top items on the agenda for bilateral talks. And so I think that the importance that Obama placed on working with China on the Iran nuclear issue did help spur China's position and ultimately China's support for 1929. The other factor, and this gets back to Israel, we all have been talking about the role that Israel plays in influencing different countries. And I do think in China there is concern about a war in the Persian Gulf and the instability that would create and the negative impact that would have on China's interests. And so I do think that that's a factor that's out there as well. And so I think that, one way to put it, perhaps is the more concerned the Chinese are about some sort of military action in the Persian Gulf region, perhaps the more willing they would be to support sanctions, however distasteful they find them in other measures. But I think, as Fiona mentioned, I think that, there is a sort of a struggle to figure out what to do next. On the one hand, as I mentioned earlier, there's this shared disdain for sanctions. Over the years that I've done interviews on this subject, in Beijing, one of the answers I've often gotten when I've asked about, what could be done if you don't like sanctions, what could be done? One of the answers I've often gotten is, oh, this is a problem for the U.S. and Iran to work out, that, the Iran views U.S. as a big threat to its security, so the U.S. needs to solve this problem. And that might partly have been a dodge, a way to avoid answering a question that, for whatever reason, they didn't want to talk about. But I think there might have been some truth to that, although there might have been a change, as Ken Pollack was mentioning on the earlier panel, that in his view, it was a real wake-up call when the Chinese said to the Iranians, look, the U.S. is giving you everything you want for rapprochement. We think you should take it, and then they didn't.
Mm-hmm. In terms of convergent interests, I think Fiona and Erica have covered most of them. There is some discussion in India from especially the left and to a certain extent the center left, both looking at the sanctions as well as the situation in the Eurozone these days, about having the BRICS do more together not in terms of actually creating an alternate or at least supplementary kind of economic order where they actually act on these issues both economically and politically in a coordinated fashion. That hasn't gained as much traction for various reasons. India doesn't have any desire to give up reliance on a Western system for a system that would be dominated by Russia and China, which are less transparent, and at least in the case of China, there are political issues involved that need to be resolved. There will continue to be discussion about this, however, because people really see this as a source of kind of constraint on Indian freedom of action, is how to actually deal with the situation, and there'll be discussions with Russia and China given the similar experiences. The other thing that is actually not so much a convergent interest, but I think a shared view of in what all three countries, they don't like the public pressure. I think private pressure for them allows them to undertake certain action because they can argue it differently, at least in India's case, to its public. Public pressure from the U.S. actually makes it harder for the Indian government to do things that it would otherwise want to do in terms of restraining the relationship with Iran, because it needs to prove, at least to its opposition parties, that it is not doing this because of U.S. pressure, or it hasn't sold its soul to the U.S. So in that sense, it's something we've discussed before. There is kind of a shared view about what U.S. public pressure really does for the government's freedom of action. On the nuclear question in terms of red lines, India feels it's not part of the nuclear discussions. It feels, unless it's in a bilateral sense, it feels it has limited leverage. And in many ways, India doesn't want to get involved. A former diplomat writing in an Israeli newspaper, I think, ended his article or op-ed saying, India should just keep its head down, and that's pretty much what has been the attitude, is let's not get involved. We want the diplomatic process to continue, but there are already a lot of actors involved. I think Fiona's point about if there are further terrorist attacks that are seen as originating or being sponsored by Iran on Indian soil, that will be more of kind of a red line in that sense. But even there, and it'll be hard for the Indian government to continue to underplay kind of an Iranian connection with that.
Okay, I think we could turn to audience questions at this point. This gentleman over here.
With the introduction,
wait for your mic. Just wait for your mic. Wait for your mic. And if you could identify yourself, please.
Mike Dean, Johns Hopkins University. With the introduction of the Third Energy Program in 2011 by the EU, which emphasized the European diversity as well as unbundling of gas resources and energy resources out of Russia, it seemed to be that Europe was on a movement which was very pro-American, in the sense that the Americans were trying to push them into less dependence on Russian oil and gas. To what extent do these sanctions against Iran, which was going to be one of the potential alternatives, especially in the Southern Stream and Nabucco pipelines, to the whole European thrust to less dependence on Russia, is this a reversal of course for the future?
Do you
want to
take another question, or should we?
Why don't you go ahead and answer that?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a pretty critical question for Europe, and it gets to the heart of, you know, my last comment, that it's actually quite a heavy lift, because the Europeans have been very serious about these attempts to shift their sources of supply for energy. This has also included, of course, more emphasis on renewables and trying to reach their various climate change targets, all of which have really taken a hit because of the nuclear decisions that were made in Germany in the wake of the Fukushima disaster in Japan, when, of course, Germany made that huge step almost immediately afterwards in deciding to curtail its own civilian nuclear program. So all of the calculations that the Europeans had been making for the years prior to rolling out this strategy that you're referring to were all thrown on their head. However, as we also know, the oil and gas markets have changed rather dramatically. And on the last panel, of course, you had David Goldman and others who have been looking at this in real detail. There's now the question of shale gas, not just in the United States, but globally. And there's a question also for the Russians and the Chinese. And there is some expectation now that there still will be this opportunity to diversify away from Russia because of the new sources of energy. Of course, there's the question of the environmental impact, which always has a huge political salience in the European context, that there will be more opportunity, in fact, for diversification. Poland and Ukraine look likely to have a large deposit of shale gas. There's also the question of tight oil. There's even the prospect of exports from the United States sometime 3 to 5 years down the line that many people are looking at. The Chesapeake Energy reference that Erica made, the Chinese, the Russians, everyone's now looking into this whole changes in natural gas markets. But nonetheless, in the short to medium term, the sanctions on Iran are a major problem that they have to contend with. There is the question now of looking further afield. Iraq, obviously, is still an issue there. That you're seeing now a lot of Turkish energy companies now taking a bigger role in Iraq, in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Obviously, a lot of political questions riding on that too, and seeing whether Iraq and some of Iraqi natural gas can be brought to market more quickly. There's also questions now of Africa. Tanzania, some of the European oil majors and energy majors have just made new finds off the African coast. There's the Eastern Mediterranean, another contentious issue, off Israel, Lebanon, Cyprus, where, you know, the Turks and others have been rather alarmed at how that has moved across. So the bottom line in all this is the international oil and gas markets are in considerable flux. There are new sources of production, new sources of supply. It's the short term where the European Europeans are really hurt by everything and are scrambling around trying to figure out how to address this. Over the longer term, when we get to thinking, and Suzanne and others have looked at this in great detail, about how do you try to put some carrots on the table for Iran, it obviously is this issue of how do you get Iran back in the game, because one of the points that could be made to the Iranians is the longer this goes on, the less likely Iran is to be able to come back in a major way as an oil and gas supplier, because the markets will move on and look for other opportunities. And so that is one small point of leverage that we actually do have in thinking ahead, particularly the Europeans really have with Iran. But of course, it's an issue that is quite complex.
I just might add on the European shale gas, the three countries that are typically cited as having major reserves are Poland, Ukraine, and France. France has banned fracking, so they've taken shale off the table. And I just read recently that Exxon pulled out of Poland. Some of its exploratory wells had not yielded very much. So there's some question about what is commercially really available in Poland. And then as far as Ukraine is concerned, I think there's some questions regarding its investment climate and what's happening politically there. So there's some, I would say, shakiness going on with regard to the initially exuberant response to shale gas in Europe. Right here.
Hi, my name's Aaron Massera. I'm with the European Parliament Liaison Office. So as you can imagine, my question will be to Dr. Hill. With the European Union sanctions, does it show a more cohesive and lasting effect of the ultimate long-term goals of the Lisbon Treaty? And will this create a more diplomatically aggressive European Union that will work more with the U.S. towards the Middle East region in the future?
If only on your last point. let's just, I'll try to answer this quite quickly. The EU sanctions has been one area where indeed Europe has proven itself to be cohesive. Unfortunately, I don't think one can really extrapolate from there across the board. My colleague at the Europe Centre, Justin Weiss, who many of you will have heard speak, engages every year in a project with the European Council on Foreign Relations, the EU Foreign Policy Scorecard, which you may have seen we had a rollout of that relatively recently. And this is one area where the EU gets really high marks. Let's just say they don't necessarily reach the same marks on many other issues. This has actually proven to be one area where the EU has been able to work together so well, because there's actually all the shared common interests that we've talked about. This not... Well, stunning, of course, it's been very difficult, as I said, the outset for Spain, Italy, Greece, and some other countries really to get on board here. And some of the big European energy companies, Eni, Italian company, for example, have really taken a hit as a result of this. This has been very problematic for them. Total, the French company, has always been very interested in upping its involvement in Iran. So this has been very difficult. But the strategic perspective has really played out here. And it has really shown, I think, the strength in many respects of the Action Service and Lady Ashton. This has been one area where she has not missed an opportunity to really engage, and where there's been really high marks from others within Europe, which hasn't always been the case for poor Lady Ashton. She's obviously often been berated, in fact, for trying to take action on other issues. In this case, she's got a lot of support, and she's also had a lot of praise from Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, I don't think that this is something that really plays out on a number of other issues. So it shows a very good example of what can be done when Europe shares the same perspective, and it could be a model for the future, but right now it doesn't seem to have that much potential, given all the complexities and so many other issues, for really being able to be the basis for a more aggressive policy across the whole of the Middle East and North Africa. And I think we're seeing in Syria and many other instances where there's a lot more confusion and contention about what should be done. Iran has just been one of those issues that has managed to really provide a very good focal and unifying point for Europe.
This gentleman right here.
Hossein Shahbazi with Webster University. I have a question from Dr. Hill. Amongst the factors that you mentioned for Russians to change policy and go along with the Americans' side, I didn't hear, I don't know if it was purposely or not, that a couple of other things that, you know, been mentioned a lot, reset policy by Obama administration, as well as not going along with the, you know, anti-missile batteries in Poland. Do you think those are also main factors, or you just didn't see any significance in them? Secondly, also, I wonder if you see any change of strategy or policy as a result of Putin's presidency. In other words, all along I've been hearing and reading that, you know, the Russians accept civilian nuclear activities by Iran, but I was surprised that you mentioned that their red line is even no capability at all for Iran. So is that because of this new presidency, or it's been always like that, or I misunderstood? If I may also ask a Chinese question, is that, you know, Ms. Downs, you mentioned that the Chinese, because of their prime place they put on the relationship with the Americans, they are not, they have not taken advantage of the discount they could get from Iranian oil. But you also said that, you know, the next 180 days would be challenging for the Russians. So in the context of what they have not taken any advantage of discount this time, why would you say that they would perhaps reverse and take another action? Thank you.
Yeah, just quickly on the issues of missile defense and other factors in the reset. I'll be honest that I don't think that those were actually the major motivating factors for Russia, and I differ in many respects from a lot of other analysts on this perspective. I actually see that it was this complex of pressures that were put on Russia, including from the United States, but actually with a very strong influence of Germany, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and many other countries that engaged with Russia behind the scenes, that were really decisive in Russia's calculations about 1929 sanctions in June of 2010. Now, of course, you know, our administration is going to take credit for that. Every administration does, and I'm sure at home the Saudis might have done if, you know, they'd been asked these questions, the Israelis, the Germans, and everybody would have done so. Everybody likes to think that it was the results of their efforts and their efforts alone that had an impact. And it's not that the relationship with the United States was not consequential. It certainly was. But the Russians have always viewed the reset policy as being much more the U.S.'s decision to reset the relationships rather than theirs. And just as Tanvi and Erica have pointed out on the allergy that other countries have for political pressure, the Russians would certainly never admit that it was U.S. public pressure that was a decisive factor on anything. They always come up with other reasons for that. Missile defense remains a major irritant for the Russians. That's a whole separate set of conversations. But it's certainly true that the Russians did have an interest in joining the United States and that reason, because of also of the relationship there. But it was all of these factors together. The United States relationship with Russia on its own would not have been sufficient to sway Russia's calculations back there in 2010. And that also brings up the other question that you asked about the change of policy with Putin. And I perhaps wasn't as clear when I was making the distinctions about Russian red lines as I should have been. The Russians have always thought that Russia should have the perfect right for a civilian nuclear program, as many other countries should do. And I also was trying to make the point that the Russians also feel that it's inevitable that Iran will get the capability to produce a nuclear weapon, that there's not much that Russia or anybody else can do about it. They look at many other countries who have gone in that direction, and they were not able to stop them. India is one case in point, Pakistan, North Korea, there's also Japan, South Africa, and Israel, and other countries behind the scenes who have enrichment capacity that they've developed. Russians think that, you know, the Iranians should have a degree of their own independent enrichment capacity. What they don't really want to see is to Iran to actually get the bomb, to actually physically make one and test one in the North Korean. And that's what I was trying to get across. They're really just also hoping, like everyone else, that the Iranians won't do this, and they're trying to dissuade them from going down that path. Although Russia, like everyone else, has not really figured out how you dissuade a country from doing this. They just want to make their preferences felt very strongly. And that, there's no real change with Putin about this. Putin has always made it clear that when it comes to these kinds of issues, he was always in the driving seat anyway. The United States was well aware back in 2010 that even though Medvedev, as president, may be more forward-leading, more willing to make it kind of clear that Russia was basically working in closer association with the United States, that it, the decisions on this issue were really residing also with Putin. What Putin, the difference will be, is he will not want to make it clear that he's working with the United States. He will be much less forward-leaning than Mr. Medvedev. And the infamous hot mic episode, if you might recall, when Mr. Obama was assured by Mr. Medvedev that he will transmit to Vladimir, this is always underscoring that Vladimir was always very much in charge of this and many other issues. It's just he would prefer it not to be known that he's being transmitted to. So basically, as I mentioned, with Mr. Putin, he likes to do things behind the scenes. He likes to make deals. He has ways of making those deals enforced. He would just prefer not to be talking about them in public, and that's the real distinction. Medvedev was a more open personality, and his presidency was somewhat more open, and that's what made the reset look much nicer, because he was a warmer, friendlier version of Mr. Putin, and as we saw during, well, we couldn't fail but see, thanks to the various newspapers juxtaposing the pictures of Mr. Obama and Mr. Putin looking somewhat uncomfortable together, that's how we're going to be looking in the future. Mr. Putin doesn't necessarily look very comfortable either with Prime Minister Singh or even his Chinese counterparts during his last meeting. It's just not a comfortable person to be sitting next to. So I think that's, and having sat next to him once at dinner, I can assure you that it's not the friendliest of settings. So I think that, you know, we shouldn't read too much into all of this, but that's the way that Mr. Putin operates. He likes to keep things close to himself, and he will hope that the United States will understand that moving forward.
On the question about China-Iran oil trade, when the sanctions were signed into law after that happened, there's a lot of concern, I think, here in Washington about what the Chinese would do. Would the Iranians offer them discounted prices? And in response, would the Chinese take advantage of that to import even more crude from Iran than they did last year? And, you know, so far that hasn't been the case, that unnamed Sino-OPEC officials have, you know, told Reuters that they've turned down offers to buy more at discounted prices. And, you know, they've also said that they were targeting reductions of 16% to 20% of imports from Iran over 2012. And I don't see Sino-OPEC, my personal view is I don't see them taking advantage of, you know, additional discounts the Iranians might offer simply because Sino-OPEC has its eye on getting into and expanding in the U.S. market. But my comment about how it might be difficult for China to get another exemption 180 days from now wasn't because I thought Sinopec's going to buy larger volumes of discounted crude, but it refers to the fact that this contract dispute that is largely responsible or almost entirely responsible for the reductions in China's buys from Iran that we've seen this year, that ended in late March. And because it takes 21 days for oil to get from Iran to China, we didn't get a first look at what the volumes of the new contract would look like until last week when the data on China's oil imports from Iran in the month of May came out. And that shows that China imported 520,000 barrels per day, so on par with what they were importing last year. And so if December rolls around and for the months of, you know, June through November, the data shows that China's been buying 500,000 barrels per day, that imports have increased over 2012, and they're on par with 2011 levels, then I think that makes it obviously a lot more difficult for the Obama administration to give the Chinese an exemption. So that was my point.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Randy Sliff again. I was hoping to just drill down a little bit specifically on the negotiation that just took place and with respect to China and Russia and their role in the last two sets of negotiations, both with respect to philosophy and with respect to practice. And then sort of bridge that into whether you actually think the Chinese are willing to effectively play ball, cut oil purchases, and support an effort that will attempt to force the Iranians to take actions and have impact with respect to some type of change of behavior, because the fact is that most sanctions really will not work unless it's a world class player having a dominating role. And then I was hoping just to get one brief view of from China and from Russia on whether they believe Israel is serious. Is the view that Israel will really take action, or is the view that there's a lot of hyperbole and a lot of smoke? And what's the perception of if Israel does take action the day after?
I can start with China. I think a useful way to answer your question is to look back to China's response to CISADA, to the U.S. unilateral sanctions that we implemented in 2010, and also to the and related to that, to the other unilateral sanctions that the EU and other countries implemented after 1929. And as you may recall, after, and that had been, my understanding is that had been one of the Obama administration's objectives for 1929, that 1929 wasn't just an end in itself, but it was supposed to serve as a platform so that other countries would feel comfortable implementing unilateral sanctions. And so my sense is that, when that was over, obviously the administration was quite pleased that all these different unilateral sanctions had been implemented, but there was a real concern about China, and specifically about what the Chinese oil companies were going to do in the Iranian upstream, because on the one hand, yes, the Europeans and the Japanese and everyone else was now pulling out as a result of home country sanctions, but there was concern that that just opened up the playing field for the Chinese, and were the Chinese companies going to take advantage of this, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to dominate the Iranian upstream. And so to prevent that, a message, was sent, I think, very clearly from the Obama administration, not just the Chinese government, but to Chinese oil companies, that, a red line in the sand for us is you backfilling, you taking over oil projects that were abandoned by the European companies, that were abandoned by Japanese companies. And my take on that is that that message was received loud and clear, and there are reports out there that in response to that, the Chinese government instructed Chinese oil companies not to backfill and to slow down in Iran. And certainly history bears that out. Fast forward 2 years, and what have we seen? What we're seeing is the Chinese companies, they haven't backfilled, and they've continued to slow walk their existing projects in Iran. There have been reports, over the past, year and a half about the Iranians threatening the Chinese companies, saying you're way behind schedule, you've not kept to the development schedule that's stipulated in the contract. If you don't hurry up, we're going to take this contract away from you and give it to domestic Iranian companies. Now, I have no idea how seriously the Chinese companies take that threat. I think that when that threat was made to Total, the French company, when it was made to Inpex, that if you don't hurry up, we're going to take your contract away and give it to the Chinese, I think that was a much more credible threat to those companies because the Chinese companies were waiting in the wings. But I don't know that any of these Iranian firms necessarily have the capital. What the Chinese companies do, and, of course, I think part of the reason, for the Iranian government, I suspect that one of the reasons of wanting Chinese companies there is to send the message that we're not internationally isolated, that Shell and, that the U.S. and the European, not the U.S., sorry, the Japanese and the European companies may leave, but we still have, friends in high places. And that hasn't certainly worked out for the Iranians, that there's not a lot going on. There are still reports, of Iranians threatening the Chinese companies. And so I think that's sort of a good example of how, the U.S., in my view, has been able to sort of to get China to tacitly cooperate on Iran. And again, as with India, this is something that I think the Chinese prefer to do quietly behind the scenes. You're never going to see anyone from the Chinese government come out and say, we told Sinopec and CNPC slow down in Iran to support the U.S. And that's the message I was getting about the Chinese response to these latest sanctions in Beijing earlier this month, that some of my colleagues there were saying, if you want to know whether we're going to cooperate or not, look at the trade numbers, look at our import numbers, but don't you ever expect anyone from the Chinese government to come out and say that these drops are a result of U.S. pressure or a decision on the part of the Chinese leadership to play ball on U.S. sanctions.
Yeah.
China and Israel?
China believe that Israel is
I mean, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I think it probably changes over time. I don't have a clear answer right now. What I can tell you, though, is that if you look back in the run-up to 1929 and sort of that there were a lot of trips made to Beijing by officials from Saudi Arabia, by officials from Israel. These were reported in the press. You had, you know, the head of the Israeli Central Bank. You had, I think, the head of Israel military intelligence. And so I think, you know, one of the messages that they were delivering was that, you know, there needs to be movement on Iran. And I think that played into the Chinese calculation. You know, it's hard for me to separate, and I don't know that you necessarily can separate them out. I mean, but you did have, I think, that the pressure from the U.S., you know, the pressure from Saudi Arabia, which I can also get into, and there's a lot, there's actually a lot more out there in the public domain on the pressure that the Saudis put on the Chinese, you know, vice the Israelis. But my general sense, and again, this is something you don't see as much sort of out there in public Chinese discussions, but just my sense from following this issue over the years, is that the Chinese government, you know, the Chinese oil companies, they, you know, they don't want to see conflict in the Persian Gulf. And so my sense is that if things get to a point where they feel like conflict is more likely, you know, I think that's sort of one of the factors that might facilitate, you know, sort of a greater willingness to cooperate on some of these other ideas that the United States has, however distasteful they might be in Beijing.
Well, I mean, Russia is in a very similar position of this. And I mean, Randy, I think you were trying to get at this question before when you asked this about, you know, the sort of philosophy and practice behind everything. In 2010, you know, as I was mentioning in response to the other kind of questions, the Russians did start to think that Israel was really serious. It's not so clear that they think that that is the case right now. And it comes, you know, back to Erica's point about, you know, their gauging of, you know, kind of the outreach that they get from the perspective of Israel. Because in 2010, the Israelis really put a full-court press on the Russians. Netanyahu went on a not-so-secret visit to Moscow to meet with Mr. Putin, you know, behind the scenes. And remember, Mr. Putin wasn't actually the president at that particular juncture. He was the prime minister. There was also a whole host of outreach by various other figures behind the scenes. Given this 1 million Russian speakers who are there in Israel right now, there are all kinds of links that you would never have thought of before. Natan Sharansky, the famous dissident who, you know, we all remember the episode of him walking across the bridge and really kind of marking the Soviet Union opening up for the doors for all of the Soviet Jews who wanted to leave. His brother, who had become a United States citizen, had gone back to Moscow again and was reputedly, according to some high-level Russians that I spoke to, also acting as a liaison. So there are all these kinds of linkages, people that you would never have thought of engaged in passing messages, senior Russian officials, people close to Putin going and visiting Israel, Russian oligarchs who have holdings in Israel as well as in Russia and in the United States passing messages back. So Mr. Putin got them. And just like his Chinese counterparts, the last thing he wants to see is any Israeli action, which would just upset the entire balance of power in the Middle East. And this is why it gets back to your first question about practice and philosophy. And it would be interesting to hear the Indian perspective on this, because the Russians have a very different view of Iran from the Europeans in the United States. They don't look at Iran as a theocracy. They look at Iran as an ancient state and an ancient state interlocutor dating back to the Persian Empire for the Russians one way or another. And I think that's what Tanvi was touching upon. We were talking about the cultural and historic links. And the Russians don't think that, you know, the Iranians for 1 second think like Europeans or the United States. Maybe they don't even think like Russians. And they know that they've had centuries of trying to deal with them and trying to figure them out. And they haven't quite entirely got there yet. But they don't believe that the way that we've chosen to deal with them is the right way to go about it. Sanctions is just, you know, it's a loss of face. And the Russians are trying to figure out how they can get leverage with the Iranians and also make it seem that whatever the Iranians decide to do, it looks like they've decided to do it and that they have saved face and even gained face. That's the way the Russians operate too. They think that this public pressure is counterproductive. They'd rather do things behind the scenes, figure out what a hook they can get into, you know, really the Iranians. They thought actually Bushehr was a hook. They kept dragging it on. It took forever to construct that plant. And it wasn't because they were trying to get more money. They were trying to draw it out, because once it's constructed, it's into operation, you've got nothing over them anymore. The S-300s, they were constantly going to send them. They never did. And then, of course, they had to cancel the sale entirely because they were also trying to play with this. They were trying to persuade the United States it was better to, you know, keep going through with the the pretense that they were going to send them in many respects, because that would give them something to talk to the Iranians about. Well, eventually, you can't keep pretending forever. So the Russians are always trying to find some way of getting some leverage, but of being able to talk to the Iranians in their own terms, behind closed doors, and to give Iran the chance to basically make the decision for them for themselves. And that may be also the way that the Indians are trying to play with this. I'm not sure that the Chinese have the same perspective, because actually they don't have a long history. In spite of being an ancient kingdom, they don't necessarily have a long history of dealing with the Persian Empire in the way that the Indians and the Russians do. So, I mean, Tanvi, I mean, is that a similar way that the Indians think about this?
Yes, you'll never, for example, hear the phrase in a media discussion amongst policy debate that Iran is not a rational actor. It's very much seen as kind of an old civilization. In some quarters, you even hear the argument that why should India object if they really do get the bomb? That as a civilizational power, now this is a limited question, and the official Indian view on this has always been, unlike India, which is never signatory to the NPT, Iran is and should undertake its obligations under the treaty. And so the Indian government draws a distinction between kind of India's going nuclear and Iran potentially going nuclear. But you do hear among some sections that it's an old civilization. It's one of the largest countries in the area. It has an old history, and with India, a history of kind of linkages. And it's very much seen as kind of somebody you could do business with, and that will react to not just pressure but persuasion as well. But again, not necessarily done publicly, using various kind of carrots and sticks, and in a manner that allows kind of the Iranian leadership to have some sense of security as well. I think this idea that the idea that does get traction in India. Is this idea that these sanctions and pressure are seen by some in many quarters as U.S. directed regime change, and in that sense there's more sympathy about that not being Indian policy and not wanting to be associated with that.
Yeah, and I would say that that's probably the case definitely for Russia and China, and it's the issue in Syria, in fact, that we're dealing with, that none of these countries want to see regime change forced on the outside. They'd much rather it happen internally.
I think we'll take one more question. We're kind of coming to the to the end. Yes.
The last person to have a question. I'm kind of make it a combination of two, three questions, I guess, kind of put in maybe. And put it in perspective. My first question is, if the real issue is Middle East as today regarding Iran, our relationship to the West as a whole, is having Iran as a nuclear bomb is, as we know, Iranian government have been, not I won't defend them, don't get me wrong, I don't like them. I want to make you point out this, so I'm not defending the Iranian government here. But the fact is they have been putting proposals the last 15, 20 years, at least I'm not naive too, regarding the power of the nuclear stuff Israel has. I'm not naive. It takes a time. I understand that. Why at least when they are saying that let's just make at least Middle East as a nuclear, zero tolerance for nuclear activity at least, talk about it. Hopefully all this is getting resolved by itself down the road. It takes a time. I understand that. But I'm asking the major powers putting so much energy, why even think about back channel at least, talk about this. The next question is, if you compare the relationship of the Western power and East Baba at that time, like a Cold War between Soviet Union and the West, and the power major power was U.S., Soviet Union, and China was a part of the Soviet Union. As Mr. Pollack mentioned that, China was saying, we don't understand why Iranian basically take the offer of American, which all make it to Chinese, which we get the pimple diplomacy in 1972, and also the Carter administration in 1979, the Deng Xiaoping coming power with economic development we got the last 30 years. What is the, I don't want to compare Iran with Soviet Union, but is that maybe why the American do the same thing? Somehow that work, it just doesn't work. And the last question is the whole thing is maybe regarding China, Europe, and India, this basically what we face in the world today is shift of power, not 50 or 100 or 200 years. It's a half a millennium shift from west to the east, and the power was there
for millennia before. Maybe that's the
I think the first question was regarding a nuclear free zone. If I don't know if anybody wants to take a crack at that. I think that was the first question. And then your last question was referring to whether or not we're seeing some sort of a shift of power going on at the moment.
Just on kind of the Indian view, India is not on strong footing arguing for, because a nuclear free zone would require Israel to give up capability. India is not exactly on strong ground making that argument. And it does feel that Israel has a right to be concerned about its own security, and so it would have a very hard time kind of making that, and that's partly why it doesn't want to get involved.
Yeah, I think the Chinese don't want to see Iran get a nuclear weapon, but they also don't want to see the Saudis get a nuclear weapon, or Turkey, or, you know, the Japanese, or anyone else who might see, you know, Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon as a license for them to do so as well.
Yeah, I mean, Russia has always been very happy of being at the top of the nuclear club. And obviously, clubs aren't particularly exclusive if everyone's got one. So, I mean, that's kind of part of the motivation. I mean, the one of the primary claims that the Russians still make for a larger role than just a role as a regional power, but of some maintenance in many respects of their superpower role from the Cold War, is precisely because of being in this exclusive club of being one of the major nuclear weapons countries. And obviously the dilution of that status has always been something of a concern. Soviet Union was not exactly thrilled. Other China broke out of that. But obviously probably preferred that the UK and France and other countries didn't go down that path either. Although there is now a sort of a sense of inevitability here that then, you know, as we were saying, that major powers who want to have that capability are going to go out and to get it. The Russians the last several years have actually been much more concerned about other states than they have been about Iran ultimately getting a nuclear weapon. I think no matter what they may think about this, they actually think that given the state structures of Iran, that the fact that Iran is, in their view, a rational actor, even if it's in its own specific rationale and is not in one that the United States and the Europeans have actually grasped, is that they would have probably pretty good command and control over it. They're much more worried about the North Koreans, for obvious reasons, and then they're much more worried about Pakistan for similar kinds of reasons, that they don't feel that Pakistani military has a particularly good grip on this, and they worry about the disintegration of the Pakistani state. And they've basically made this public repeatedly. So Russia has concerns about proliferation. I think where they do become concerned about the risk of knock-on effects from Iran's acquisition of a nuclear weapon is the impact that this may have on the thinking of others about acquiring it, other much less, in their view, stable states. The idea that then there'll be more Pakistans and North Koreas out there in the Russian view, and they are very concerned about that. That's one issue that they do have a genuine interest here. So it's a complex issue. But it's not that the Russians, like the Indians or even Chinese, necessarily think that that Iran's acquisition of a nuclear weapon means that everything else is going to erupt. They don't necessarily trust everyone else to behave in a certain way. So there is a great deal of concern there.
Okay, with that.
The power shift, well, the Russians have obviously been quite interested in playing the perception of power shift as much as they can, whether everybody else likes it or not. Thanks to Mr. O'Neill's conception of the BRICS, the Russians have liked to have taken that brick and holding it quite tightly themselves. Just like the idea of having their UN status or being in an exclusive nuclear club, the Russians like the idea that they might be in a new exclusive club of power shifts, with everything moving in the direction of the BRICS, Brazil, not so much in Russia's interest, but anyway, Russia, India and China, and they're playing that to the hilt. So whether the shift is real or not, the Russians are going to try to make sure that it is. We're seeing the Russians stepping out now onto larger stages. They blew off the G8, but they were very eager to go to the G20, and it wasn't just because it was in Los Cabos, which is much nicer this time of year than Washington. It's because it's a much larger environment in which you can play in. And the Russians are certainly playing up the idea that the real locus of power now is really with the Russias, Indias and Chinas of this world and not elsewhere. And so you can be sure that they're very much appreciative of every article that is written on this topic at the moment.
Great. And with that, we will conclude. Thank you very much for attending today, and have a great weekend.